Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer. In the studio today, it is Gregor Robertson, Alison Rudd and Matt Dickinson. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Lovely to see you all.
Hello, I get three.
You do get three and I like that. And Alison, first time we've got the chance to congratulate you on your SJ or A award. That's brilliant.
Thank you very much. I'm blushing. Thank you.
Oh, well, richly deserved.
Absolutely. Congratulations.
Yeah, fantastic.
Congratulations to you as well.
Thank you. We'll bypass me though.
No.
Thank you. No, that's very kind, Gregor. Thank you very much. Yes, we're full of award winners on this podcast today. Coming up, we are going to discuss Wilfried Zaha, Liverpool's unbeaten run coming to an end, and Matt Dickinson tells us about his new over 50s football team. All that to come after this.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Now, the front page of the game today reads, coming of age as the 19-year-old Phil Foden puts in a man of the match performance to help Manchester City beat Aston Villa and lift their third consecutive League Cup. 71 touches, 46 out of 51 passes completed, 5 shots and a nice assist for Sergio Aguero's opener. The performance had it all. So, Gregor, was this the performance of a man who is ready to be a Premier League regular?
Absolutely. I think in any other Premier League club, other than Liverpool perhaps, he already would be. He's technically as good a midfielder as England have, really, I think. That touch with outside of his left foot, that's the first thing that comes to mind. It was just kind of beautiful. I think it was a switch from Zinchenko and just outside of his left foot into his path. It was kind of the kind of thing that you see Riyad Mahrez do often. And I think actually this performance showed his flexibility, the fact that he's played out wide and he was still such a threat. Glides across the turf. He's really good at using his body to protect the ball for someone so slight as well. And he's deceptively quick. So, yeah, I thought it was a great performance from him. And, we've had the same discussion for quite a long time about the opportunities he's been afforded. I don't think he can hang around much longer, I think. He needs to be playing pretty soon.
Matt, you were there. How impressive was he?
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more with Gregor. That I was actually, that touch that from the Zinchenko ball was right in front of us. And I think I've written this morning, you could feel almost the whole stadium purr when you saw it. It was just to have those soft feet. But it wasn't just that, cutting back. It was a menace. There was a real punch to his game, getting shots off. I think he has to be, obviously pushing for a City place, which is going to take a bit of patience. Pep Guardiola's talking about succeeding David Silva and the fact that when Silva leaves at the end of the season, they won't need to buy a replacement. So I guess that's some encouragement for him. And I guess the really interesting question is he going to get a chance in the senior England team in the next two friendlies and therefore be pushing for Euro 2020? I mean, it's fascinating. There are a lot of players around that area. So obviously we know, why, if you're talking about the position he played yesterday, wide forward, Jadon Sancho and Raheem Sterling and Marcus Rashford are pretty pretty strong contenders. But one of the great things about Foden is that he could play in a sort of more of a number eight, deeper midfield role as well. So he's pushing very hard.
Well, you brought up England and whether or not he should be called up. Do you think he should?
On this form, I'd certainly want him in those two friendly games. I think it's, with a tournament coming up, he's also up against Mason Mount and Maddison have obviously sort of jumped ahead in terms of Southgate's look, partly because Foden hasn't had as many opportunities. But if I was an England manager, looking at the form of different players, wanting to see him up close, just see, work with him, get to know him a bit, I would bring him in now for these two friendlies just to maximise the options I've got.
I think he's the least English midfielder that England have. I mean that as a compliment, not like in a bad way. But he's like a little Spaniard. He's so technical. You know, Grealish plays with a bit of a swagger, and that's not something that England have in many players either. But to have someone, he's like a product, very much a product of this modern Manchester City, I think. He's been coached very well and so good technically. So, yeah, I mean, I think he should definitely be someone that Southgate's having a look at.
That said, the cup final was just his ninth start of the season, three of them coming in the League Cup, only two in the Premier League. Is that really enough experience, Alison, for Gareth Southgate to call him up?
Well, I think you could flip it and say it's perfect, because the problem with being an international manager and dealing with international football is that you're piecing together players who don't know each other that well. The systems might be different, philosophy might be different, the whole vibe might be different. And if Phil Foden can play like that when he isn't really part of the gang, but what I was most impressed with was the way he was at ease with the team. At some points looked like he was bossing it, totally with it, and as if it looked like the performance of someone who's played every minute of every game of the season. And that is a quality that an international manager ought to really relish, because it looked like, certainly worth trying out, isn't it, that he could slot into a reasonably established England team and work out with a bit of training how to relax into his best form. So I get your point. If he's not playing enough first team football, isn't that a negative? But you know, it probably means he's fresher than most, and something's happened along the way, because I thought he looked really confident, and like he looked like somebody who'd just walked onto the final plinth and thought, this is it, this is my moment, and didn't get overexcited either.
So you too would suggest Southgate should
look at him. It's definitely worth seeing, isn't it?
I mean, Gregor, you mentioned a bit before about if he doesn't start breaking into the squad as a regular, that he'll have to look elsewhere. But as Matt told us, and as we know, David Silva will be leaving. You would expect that he will be, from the way he plays, that natural successor. But you still feel like if it doesn't go to plan, he'll have to leave Manchester City.
Well, I think next season, if he's not playing regularly, then he has to leave, because we've been having this same discussion for 2 or 3 years. The only reason we're having this discussion about him being in the England team or not is because he's not playing enough. That'd be Southgate's argument. So, and any other club, he would be. So yeah, that seems like he has a kind of stock answer for the interviews as well. He says, you know, I've got Kevin De Bruyne and David Silva in front of me, and that's a good answer to the question, you know. But from next year he won't, so he's got to play next year, and if he doesn't, he's got to look elsewhere.
Well, there was a lot of focus on Foden, as there was on Jack Grealish, and Matt, you've been writing about Grealish in the game today. Probably was a frustrating day for the Villa captain.
Yeah, I mean, I think as much as losing the final as captain, hometown team, that's going to have hurt. But I think even more, knowing the ambition he has, and as Gregor mentioned, the swagger he has, would have been the fact that he was so peripheral in a cup final. You know, you can imagine, you know, obviously they were underdogs, but he must have thought, you know, this is Wembley, this is where I can at least, you know, strut my stuff a bit. And you know, he obviously did pick up an injury somewhere down the line. He was barely walking, barely able to run by the end. But
he had a good cramp in his calves, and they're big calves, to be fair.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And it was partly that Villa didn't function through him too much. He looked like he was trying too hard at times. I mean, there was a couple of overhit balls, and it was just one of those afternoons that didn't start great for him and just never took off. And it must be massively frustrating. And then, of course, we've just been talking about Foden. He must look at it partly from a club point of view and partly from an international point of view, yet to get this international call up that he craves. And you know, he must look at now at other opportunities. You know, I'm sure he'll be desperate to keep Villa up, but I think this summer is a real crossroads for him, depending on, you know, who comes in bidding the right sort of money.
With regards to the final then, were the tactics employed by Villa sort of, in a sense, restrict what Grealish could do? Or was actually, was he just not on his game?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, obviously, you know, City were going to dominate the ball. You know, the goal that Villa got was a sort of fast break, you know, capitalise on an error. They didn't manage to play through him too much. He was sort of chasing around, trying to But I mean, I've mentioned in the touch map this morning, you know, he only had 46 touches all game. And I think he barely had, one or two dribbles. His pass completion was down at 75%, I think. So I think it was difficult for him because it was difficult for Villa. But I just think he just looked like someone who sort of quite early sensed that things just weren't quite happening for him. Mm-hmm. And I say certainly by the second half, it was almost like he was sort of trying a bit hard.
Mm. And as you've suggested, Alison, I'll come to you on this. We've talked about Phil Foden and what future holds for him. Should he stay or should he go from Manchester City? What about Jack Grealish? Even if Aston Villa stay up, is that really the right club for him to be at, for him to progress, or should he be moving on?
Well, if he's capable of being objective about his life and career, he ought to be very intrigued by how he would function at a different club, because he's completely defined by his connection to the club, his love for the club, staying with them. You know, I'm struggling to think of another Premier League set of fans who have a connection with a player who plays regularly as the Villa fans do with Jack Grealish. There's just so much love for him. You know, the replica haircuts, he's a cult figure there.
That'd be hard to leave behind.
Well, I'm saying if he could put all that to one side, it would be intriguing for everybody else and possibly for him and the people close to him to know how he would function without that bolstering him. Because I think that does define partly how he plays and how his manager treats him. He's a talisman and an icon, and everything is about him. Every build-up to any big game for Villa is about Jack Grealish, because it's just too easy. It's just the narrative, isn't it? It's that local guy who is talented enough to go to a bigger club, who isn't struggling to stay in the Premier League. But I do think when you watch him play, and let's take the final away, because it's a Wembley appearance and probably there was too much on his shoulders. But I've seen other games where you think, I don't think there's another club that would allow Jack Grealish that freedom on the pitch. He dictates the rhythm of a game often, and that can serve Villa well, and sometimes it does not serve them well. They need to be a bit more pragmatic and calm sometimes. So it may be he's not very much at all without Villa. It may be he's just a scampering lunatic if you take away the club, or it may be it allows him to step up to become a more mature player with more to him. So it's intriguing. It could backfire horribly if he left for a bigger club, and he could disappear.
It would definitely need to be the right move. That's all you've got to say, because as we've seen with Foden, with potential without game time is worthless, really. He needs to, wherever he goes, he still needs to be an important figure at that club.
Well, Liverpool will not match Arsenal's unbeaten season after a humbling 3-0 defeat at Watford on Saturday night. It means their incredible run of 18 straight league wins and 40 games undefeated is over, just short of Arsenal's 49 undefeated record. Alison, we know Liverpool are still going to win the league, so do you care about losing the unbeaten record?
I actually don't, not at all. Didn't feel sad, glum. At all, didn't mind at
Come
all.
On,
I was very
Alison.
Glad. No, I was very, very glad it wasn't City or United or Everton that did it. Mm-hmm. What did it? I found myself, you can say I'm fibbing, but this is the truth. I found myself utterly admiring Watford because I thought what Liverpool thought, which was they're going to get tired, they can't keep this up. And this is partly how Liverpool have kept this amazing run going, is because they time it so well. And teams really lift their game and they lift it too far. And then in the final 10, 15 minutes, they just can't keep up with it. And Liverpool slice them apart. Watford did not rest. I did find myself thinking, good on you, Watford. And I hope every Liverpool fan now hopes that Watford stays up for doing it.
Well, as things stand, and let's say this is just a little blip and Liverpool get back to their unbeaten ways, they will win the Premier League title with a record points total. Given the choice then, Alison, and I might ask all of you this, would you rather that, so they win the Premier League title with a record point total, or win the title but be invincible? That's my question to you.
Oh, record points total, obviously. Can't have the other one.
No, I know, but I'm just asking, if you could have had either, what,
I think the record points total is more relevant because it's more recent, mm-hmm. and it feels more like a proper competition, whereas Arsenal have now become, I don't know, something like the Pavarotti story or something. I mean, it's ancient history. Who cares?
Well, clearly Arsenal do.
Yes.
Judging by their Twitter action.
Greg, what about you? Where would you stand on that debate?
There's merits to both, obviously, because, you know, a record points haul is the best points haul of any club. But then there is something unique and kind of pretty special about throughout a whole season not being able to prevent yourself from losing, you know, coming back from being behind and just not losing. That's incredible. Everyone loses. So that is an incredible feat that Arsenal achieved. And I think Liverpool will sort of look back and regret this a little bit, personally. Mm. I think as well, if Liverpool were to go out in Europe at any time before the final, the season could be a little bit of a whimpering end in a year that they've won the title for the first time in 30 years. That would seem remarkable.
A whimpering end, Alison. Can you believe he's just said that?
He just wants more Twitter followers.
I'm with Gregor. I think it would have been... I'm not saying that they'll be losing sleep over it now, but I just think it would have been a great thing to chat. And I do think there is... In my mind, there is something more special about the feat of an invincible season than trying to work out, did City get the most points? How many more points was that than someone else? I don't keep a rolling hole in my head of what is the record points and how much did it beat anyone else by it. But I do, you know, you say Arsenal is invincibles to me and I'm instantly seeing the team, remembering the season, so...
Yeah,
but it doesn't. It's meaningless because Liverpool have lost games this season. So it's you're invincible in the league. Yeah, but you know, Atletico beat them 1-0 the other day. I mean, so what? It's like it's the overall thing. Not
to go through a whole league campaign without losing is a remarkable achievement. And I think Liverpool. I look, they win the league, and it's going to be a remarkable season for them, but. If they don't win the Champions League as well or even get to the final or something, I think there'll be something just a little bit in the back of some of the players' minds thinking this isn't quite what it looked like it could have been at kind of Christmas time.
Well, other than Watford, the other big winner of that result at Vicarage Road was, of course, Arsenal, who will continue to be that invincible side for the time being. But should we be considering them the all-time greatest Premier League side because of that achievement? You've got City's Centurions, United's treble winners, Chelsea's 2005 side have all made their mark on the Premier League. But I want to ask all of you for your top three Premier League sides of all time. So,
a lot of grimaces and faces.
I know.
It's so hard because actually, you know, the more I was thinking about it, there are some teams that, I mean, clearly won't be on anyone's top three. But you know, the Arsenal of '98 and that was fantastic. And then actually, you know, pushes the United treble winners of '99 so hard. I mean, I think they only lost the league to them by a point. Obviously, there was the famous FA Cup semi-final and the replay. I mean, you know, that was over those couple of seasons. Obviously, United treble drowns out their sort of 99 efforts, and understandably so. But you know, say I'm sure that team won't feature on anyone's list, but it was absolutely formidable.
Yeah. Well, Matt, what is your top three then?
I'm going to pass on to the others for now.
Oh, okay.
I'm still fine-tuning. Well, actually, if you want, to be honest, I'll have to go. I don't actually think this is more, this is less the head talking than just the sense of covering the treble season felt. And I, you know, people come back and say, well, are you arguing strictly on the Premier League? But I just think covering that team, that season, I've not experienced anything like it and possibly won't again. It was just, you know, and I know I'm there for, say, bringing in the FA Cup and the European campaign and all the drama, but it was just remarkable. I mean, even winning the league was you know, they did it, you say, right to the end and in a special way. Am I right? Coming from behind against Tottenham, was it, on the last day, I think? Might have to correct that. But I think it was right to the death. And that team, for all it accomplished, the treble like that, I'm afraid it probably... I have to go with it, even though, you know, I find myself, something in my head's going, what, you're not picking the Invincibles, you know, and Thierry Henry and
well, don't they come second in your list then?
Yeah, probably just for that achievement. But then, you know, I also find myself thinking, you know, there's arguments that Fergie's first team, the great 94 side, were just in their power and must. Yeah, they used to batter teams. I mean, they were the power of that side, might have given the treble winners a tough time. So it's tough, but I'll go with 99 United.
You were right, by the way. They did come back from being a goal down at home.
Even my Tottenham. my memory's not as bad as
it's a minefield, this, because I know we're going to get too deep, aren't we? But like, you could think about the style of play. You could think about, I think there's something about the context and the narrative, and there being some jeopardy.
Well, I didn't set a criteria.
Well, I know. Yeah,
That's why I brought in the, you know.
I would say Arsenal's invincibles because they were like a mixture of a relentless machine with some of the greatest artists in the team that the Premier League has ever seen, like Henri and Bergkamp and Pires, with Vieira in the team and Sol Campbell at the back and Lauren. You know, it was a ridiculously good team. So and the fact that they never lost. So they're my number one. I would say the treble winning team, Manchester United, are number two, because I don't think you can ignore the context. No other team has ever done that. No team's won the treble before. And the third one is really, really hard. I think also you need some sort of separation with time as well. But I think Man City's Centurions team, it was so new. The style of football they played was like nothing that the Premier League had ever seen before. And I even, you know, I don't particularly like the fact that it was such a team that was assembled at a ridiculous cost. And you know, we're seeing now that there could potentially be some asterisks beside it. But the football that was played there was like nothing we've ever seen before. So I think they would be my number three.
Okay. All right. Alison?
They're all wrong.
Is it going to be Liverpool?
No, in third place. It's
always like the awards night again.
Chelsea winning the title in 2017, because it's the first time ever the narrative has been about a switch in formation. I've not reported on anything like that before. Chelsea were embarrassed at Arsenal, and at half time Antonio Conte won the title by deciding at half time, right, I'm switching from four at the back to three at the back, and it worked so well. He stuck with it. That was remarkable. And like you both my colleagues have said, you can't separate what you were doing, and I covered a lot of that. And I was there for a lot of it, so it's bound to matter more to me because I saw it unfold firsthand. But I just think we didn't know a lot about Conte, and he was a tactical genius. And I just liked it was different. In second place, I think you can't love football if you don't put Leicester in there, because Leicester gave everybody so much happiness. Yeah. And it's the same old, all the time. And lines are drawn tribally. And there's no United fan who loves a City title win. There's no Liverpool fan who loves a United title win. But everybody loved the Leicester story. It was silly. It was inexplicable. But there was some beautiful football. It threw up new heroes. I mean, N'Golo Kante suddenly became the most coveted midfielder of all. Mahrez, again, we didn't really know how beautiful he could play until he started winning the title. And Jamie Vardy, I mean, incredible character, and he came from non-league. I mean, it was the stories were fantastic, and dilly ding, dilly dong, and all that. I just can't believe that doesn't make every single person in the universe's list if they love football. And then top, I would
put. Considered.
And top, I'd.
They're going to scrape in third, maybe.
But top, I put Liverpool because I have to. I admit I have to. But
why
do
you have to?
I have to because I love them. And I'm loyal, but also I think it again the narrative is interesting because Klopp has played more adventurously and Liverpool have been more attractive in recent years than they are this season, but he has done what he's had to do to give them that element of ruthlessness and pragmatism to make sure that they finally win the Premier League title. So it's not just this season, it's the Klopp journey to this season is mesmeric.
I think we all expected Liverpool to be top of the pile for Alison. But I liked it because yours wasn't as conventional as Matt and
Rebels. They were good answers in their own ways.
Yeah.
In their own ways.
Although did you give us your third best?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, to be honest, Leicester would probably have got on there. I mean, yeah, again, as Alison said, more for the drama, really. I mean, you know, the fact that if you're putting them against, say, Mourinho's first Chelsea team, you know, I think they would fancy their chances against that Leicester. But in terms of the story, it is, yeah, what are we here for? We're here for drama and great stories as much as we are for, you know, great sort of sport. Well, it's all part of the same thing, isn't it? And I think that
They did play good football,
Matt. No,
but it's not, you know, absolutely. They did play some good football, but it was... You know, if you're talking about sort of pitching one side against the other of greatest, what had the, you know, who could do it again? Obviously, Mourinho's team did it more than once, didn't they? So it's, you know, there is, you know, it depends really whether you're going a bit with the sort of heart and the sentiment. And
we
I guess
stricter criteria, that's what we're saying.
Yeah, no, exactly.
No, that's absolutely fine. There was none set.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Do you know what? I think we should talk about Wilfried Zaha. Henry Winter has done a brilliant interview with him for The Times this week. The Crystal Palace winger speaks openly about the pain caused by being the pantomime villain of the Premier League and why he doesn't deserve to be booed everywhere he goes. Within the interview, they also discuss football and how he's pleased that VAR has come into the game to prove that he isn't a cheat nor a diver, but also on his life away from football and the orphanage that he has funded in the Ivory Coast run by his sister, Corinne. A really interesting interview. Does anyone have any sympathy for Wilfried Zaha?
I have sympathy for anyone who's booed and sort of pilloried by the supporters almost everywhere they go. But it's limited because I think he plays up to it a little bit. And I think he did again at the weekend. He was cupping his ears to the fans and wiping away imaginary tears and getting into arguments with substitutes, even if he kicked the ball at him. And the truth is, when he plays, he very often has a face like a bag of smashed crabs. He looks like...
Is that a Scottish expression?
Yes, I've never heard that before.
He looks like he's in pain. He looks like, you know, the world is against him. And he does get rough treatment. He does... Everyone accuses him of diving. But he looks like it's me against the world a little bit. And so I think probably he brings a little bit on himself.
Is he a pantomime villain, Alison?
He's become a pantomime villain because he's a bit different and human beings are cruel and they don't like people who are different. He's a very emotional man. Henry said in his piece he'd not met him before. I interviewed him a few years back when he came back to Palace, having had a horrible time at Old Trafford, and he was virtually in tears. He's just an emotional person and he feels things really deeply. And he feels he was sold a promise by Fergie, then Fergie left and he was left high and dry at Old Trafford. And he doesn't like the way people will see a performance and then they'll write about what it means. And it's not what he sees it as meaning. I mean, he has to be less sensitive, I suppose, because that's the way the world works. If you don't play well, people will write why they think you're not playing well. And he didn't like the assumptions being made about himself. But, I mean, it's very hard to dislike a young man who thinks deeply about things and outside of football as well and gets oversensitive about criticism. And then it wraps up in itself, doesn't it? So that's why he starts cupping his ears, Greg, because he knows he's expecting it and he's trying to deal with it and trying to make it work for him out on the pitch. But it gets more of it.
And whether that sensitivity is part of why he failed at United, also I mean, also now, why, you know, I mean, he sort of very naively, I think, and there was some of the, I think, shows reticence about him is to do, you know, with sort of career management. I mean, you know, you sign a long contract at Crystal Palace, then hope, you know, sort of wonder why you haven't got a transfer to Arsenal. Oddly enough, Crystal Palace, if they sell you, they think they're going to get relegated. So demand 80 million quid. You can't. He seemed to be wanting the sort of to have his cake and eat it a bit in terms of career management. So I think that's not always helped, shall we say, helped his case. But I do think when it comes to, do I want to see Wilfried Zaha not booted up in the air and, you know, given due sort of protection? I think the game should be about, well, certainly officiating should be to a large degree about protecting the skillful players. And he does get, he does, you know, draw his share of, more than his share of fouls.
He's also very easily wild. I mean, he's the kind of player that every manager before a game would be saying, get in his ear.
Mm.
And it, I think the last two times we've played Southampton, James Ward-Prowse has had him on toast. He's without actually, you know, it's not like he marked him out the game or anything. He could just, he had a wee smile or a wee grin on his face when he could have maybe gave him a wee nudge when it was just on the side of the pitch. And he reacts so angrily. He needs to be able to control his emotions a little bit more. And as Alison said, that's...
Would you have gone for him or, say, Pepe if you were Arsenal at that type of money?
I think Zaha's a better player, but there are some kind of question marks about his temperament. And as you say, the way his career's been managed, he's, what is he now, 26, maybe in 27? So that's a lot of money to spend and you're not probably going to see it back. So, but look, he's a fantastic player and he should be protected. I just think he could probably help himself a little bit too.
I remember speaking to Andros Townsend and he was saying about how he is unfairly treated. He doesn't get the protection that he deserves. There is that tag of cheat. There is that tag of a diver. Does he deserve that? Was that unfair, Alison?
I honestly don't think he dives more than anybody else. But players who are fast and have a few tricks up their sleeve will fall over. He doesn't have a low centre of gravity, so he will stumble if you clip his heels or just nudge him and he's going fast. I'm sure there's been a few occasions where he might look like he's thought, I'm going to deliberately fall now because I think I'm better off getting the penalty or the free kick. I don't think that's part of his psyche. I think he genuinely wants to create havoc legitimately. It's just a combination of his style of play. As Gregor says, he is targeted. I don't think Gregor sometimes managers think they should tell their players to target him. I think they all do.
Yeah.
They just know you can wind him up a bit.
But there'd be an instance,
it'd be nice if more often he took that and it made him produce a 10 out of 10 performance.
Yeah. There's been instances where it's just been so clear. I mean, Sheffield United in both games, I remember at the start of the season, Baldock, the right back, was just leaving one on him. And they were going off the pitch at half time, like arguing, and he looked enraged. And then they played in the second game. I think Baldock was booked early on, and Sheffield United just rotated and got somebody else to give him a leave the foot on him a little bit. It's part of the game. And Matthew Syed wrote a really good column actually after that game saying that it's hard to see how they would do it, but to kind of be able to punish teams for rotational fouling, as if, you know, I'm not sure how you could do that, but it's a valid point, and it was clear that Sheffield United had done it. That's something he could change. If he didn't react in the way he reacted, then teams wouldn't be quite as keen to do it.
But as it is part of the game. You're always going to want to stop the most influential player of an opposing team. But when it comes to Wilfried Zaha, Gregor, and this reputation that he comes with, how hard is that to change it, to shift that?
I think it is quite hard, yeah. I mean, as I've already said, the players know about it.
Mm.
And I think probably it does subconsciously affect some refereeing decisions. Yeah. Think of players that have been given this tag over the years. Ashley Young was another one who sometimes you would see, you think maybe that was a foul and he would be booked. And, you know, I think it can have an effect on referees as well. So I'm not sure whether he can change it now. And I think it's probably part of what makes him the player he is too, really. That's the other, most things are kind of balanced out like that. I think he's an emotional player and that's maybe how he gets the best out of himself. Mm-hmm. But it also kind of has this other side to it.
Alison, when you hear that Gregor's saying that referees could be influenced by him, the way he performs on the pitch, is that something you buy into? Do referees do that?
Well, I think referees don't like being taken for mugs, and if they believe that he falls over too easily and is looking to fall over, they will. It's only human nature that when he does fall in the game you're officiating, there's an element of cynicism in your head. But it shouldn't be there. It just shouldn't be there. And we go back to the very start of this segment, Natalie, and you mentioning VAR. I mean, this ought to, if it's in the box, certainly, it ought to be a better way of life for Wilf Saha, that it's there, if that bias has crept into the way it's being refereed. Mm. But that bias should not be there at all. But they're, you know, just human beings. And as I've said many times, so are the VAR people. They're human beings too.
Now, I'm going to end today's podcast with the big story of the weekend, over-50s football. Matt, tell us about this piece that you've written for Times Online.
Well, that'll teach me to chat to Tom in the office and just, yeah, say what I was doing at the weekend. And, it was really just... I'd given up playing 11-a-side for probably very good reasons. I'm getting old and things start to hurt. And I basically got fed up with chasing whippersnapper 35-year-olds around a pitch and being humiliated. And then luckily stumbled on a couple of mates playing there's no ringers allowed. You must be 50 plus and many are 60 plus. And it's just reborn my love for the game, that sort of childlike, you know, it's that Sunday morning, getting your boots ready, getting your shin pads ready. And, you know, players, people in at the top of the game, you know, managers especially always say, you know, nothing beats playing. And actually, you know, if there is a connection between what I do and proper football, it is just that sense of nothing beats playing football. You know, we love watching it, we love talking about it, but still to be able even... even now, still to be able to run out on a Sunday morning and feel the love of it like you're still 10, it feels quite special.
But is the problem running out on the pitch feeling like you're 10 again, but actually your body isn't anywhere near that?
Well, but that's the great thing. If you are playing with your peers, say in my case is over 50, then that does removes that sort of sense of, you know, there's always, you know, this sort of, you know, the fast, you know, youngsters running off of the ball, or, you know, and people feeling like there's not a pleasure for them in it, that it's only going to be hard work, or so, you know, we spend as much time laughing as we do passing. You know, I mean, it is just sort of one sort of calamity after another. And yet occasionally, you know, you take that shot, you trap that ball, you hit that pass, that it makes you think, I've still got it. I've still got it. It just might be a bit slower than I remember.
I love this bit in the piece where you've said you've once asked a teammate for a give and go, which got the reply, give and go, I'm 50 effing nine, I'll give, but I'm not going anywhere. And
that is a true story, honestly. It was the first time I played for them. Literally the sort of, you know, the game stopped for laughter. And again, that's you know, when you played at 10, you know, you were just thinking about having fun with your mates, and obviously things get more serious, but it does feel a bit like back to that sort of roots of why we just all have all run out with a ball when we're kids and just got those basic little pleasures from it.
And was this you that shot at goal and it hit the corner flag?
He had not played 11-a-side football for 20 something years. I mean, it was like, so I talked him back into it. He'd done his Achilles years ago and just thought, not for me. Came back and he ended up charging into the box on his wrong foot, and in the sort of confusion between limbs, brain, sort of trying to remember how you do it, he shanked his shot, which flew off towards a corner flag, and he pulled his hamstring all in the same moment. And again, we had to stop the game, A, to carry him off, and B, to stop giggling. So it's, so really it was a piece about playing football and how it can still feel a wonder even if you're old and past it.
Well, this is a great opportunity for us to sort of single out your greatest moments in your footballing careers, amateur or professional. Gregor, we're going to come to you last on this one, I think. But Alison, what about you?
I've got lots, and I don't want to be self-indulgent and lose all my great player of the match and all this sort of stuff. So,
well, this
I'm
is a podcast all about awards. So.
Yeah, no, I'm going to say when I was a little girl, I was told I couldn't play football, and the closest I got was being in goal for my friend's brother's shooting practice, which isn't playing football, that's just being hurt on purpose. And so to eventually learn to play as an adult, and again, I was in teams where they didn't want me because I could only find men's teams to start with. Mm. And I would get, "Oh, what are you doing here? You're a girl." And I know when I'm on my deathbed, I will look back and I will be so glad that I didn't, you know, just slink off feeling pathetic. I would just, I said, "Well, I want to play. I'm going to stay." Mm. And they'd go, "Oh God, all right." And then I stayed part of it because of my energy. So I would be the one that would just, I played up front because they thought it was the safest place to put me. And I would be running around harrying all the defenders, putting in lots of effort, where most people were just strolling around. And, it, you know, week by week, month by month, year by year, I got this grudging respect for always being the one that turned up. I always brought the footballs. I brought the bibs. I organised the teams. I made sure it happened. And I slowly learned a few skills along the way. And I might grab the odd talented player and say, "How did you do that? Can you show me how you did that?" And I never became a very good player. But I think my love, my absolute love for it, made sure I put up with a load of crap. And then I did play for a women's team. And, you know, I did win awards. And I used to sometimes train, play a match in the park, and then literally run up and down escalators so I could get to training with my women's team, and then breathlessly get back late at night and then go and play in a match the next day. And every hour in between work I could do that, I did it, because I was squeezing in the childhood I never had, so I had to make up for time. So I'm just really pleased I didn't let those horrible blokes at the beginning put me off, and I kept going, because it has given me my greatest pleasures in life. Is actually setting up a goal is the thing I love the most.
Oh, like
good
that.
Answer.
Nice, yeah. Matt, what about you?
Greatest. Well, this is going to sound awfully name drop, but I would say, I mean, I've been through the job, and I've been really lucky to have played at the old Wembley, played at the new Wembley, scored at the Kop End at Anfield.
Or,
none of these in games that would draw much of a crowd, it's got to be said. But I would say the greatest moment, or the greatest privilege, it's come to the last weekend of the 95 league season. There's been all this stuff between Fergie and Kenny Dalglish about, you know, who's going to bottle it, etc. And I was covering those clubs at the time, and Kenny Dalglish, in his determination to show that they were not bottling it, invited some of us to play a match against him and his backroom staff on the couple of days before the finale to the season. And so it was a sort of, you know, this is how relaxed we are, we're even going to let you lot come in. And anyway, played against Kenny, and I think Asa Hartford was playing, and I think they may have had a very young Shea Given in goal. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we lost, I think memory's right, 17-0. And I just remember spending...
It's still your greatest moment.
Well, I know, but I just remember spending this entire game thinking, I'm going to get one tackle on Dalglish. I'm just, yeah, there is going to be something that means I can just come away going, you know, I got past him, I nicked the ball off him, I did something, and I didn't get close. I mean, it was such a lesson in, you know, even when there were times he would get the ball back to me, I'd be what I thought thundering in to get him, and suddenly he would have gone one way, the ball would have gone the other, and it was such... from the sidelines, such an embarrassment, humiliation. But it felt as such a privilege to be up close to one of the greatest British players of all time, and even at whatever age he was at then, just to have a sense of a guy who can see three moves ahead. I mean, it felt like he knew, you know, he knew where I was going to go more than I did. You know, it was just it was to see a world class player up close felt very special. So yeah, losing 17-0 remains the greatest moment of our football
highlight.
Career.
Okay, come on, Gregor, let's hear yours then.
I never managed to reach the top level, but winning the League Two title, 9 months of being kind of completely invested in that achievement, that was with Chesterfield. That was great. But my best moment was actually probably my last game in professional football, winning the National League playoff final at Wembley with Grimsby Town, because the year before we'd been in the same final and we'd lost on penalty kicks to Bristol Rovers, which was so devastating to take. And the next year we were back, and I think just Grimsby, the football club is such a huge part of that town, and they'd been out of the Football League for 6 years, and to know how much it meant to everyone, we were 2-1 up against Forest Green in the final, and we were holding on for dear life, and then we scored a third in the 94th minute, and I think that's the single most kind of joyous moment I've ever had on a football pitch. We're all just running off like kind of school children, because you knew it was over, and the celebrations were pretty good too. So I think that's the most, it was a good way for me to go, to be honest. Mm. That was my best moment.
And to win an actual playoff final, that's
yeah, I mean,
special.
Winning a league title is great because you do it over a full season, and it's that's the biggest achievement, I think. But the playoffs are something unique. You know, so much pressure on them. Mm. And one day out at Wembley, because we'd been there the year before as well, we weren't allowing ourselves to lose again. It was like we knew we were going to win. We just had to go out and do it. So yeah, Wembley in the sunshine, National League playoff final, that was my best moment.
And what about since retiring? How's it been? How have you filled the void of not playing football anymore?
Well, it's funny, listen to Matt say that about kind of reminding him of playing like a kid. Professional football is nothing like that. It wasn't for me anyway. That's gone as soon as it becomes a profession. So I don't miss the actual playing football so much. I miss competition. That's the thing you can never ever replace. It's no matter what you do, it's like drawing every last sinew out of yourself every day in training, competing to get in the team against your own teammates, competing every Saturday against opposition, trying to win, trying to kind of survive sometimes at that level as well. But it's that competition is what I miss the most. I've played when I moved to London a couple of years ago. A friend of mine plays in a team that's called the Rob Roy Reds. It's full entirely of Aberdonians who live down here. So I've gone along and played a few times with them, and I really enjoyed it. It was kind of, don't get me wrong, there were some times when there was the 19-year-old whippersnapper running past me, I'm thinking, what am I doing here? But just, there's no pressure. There's no kind of, you know, you can go for a pint afterwards and you're still in your kit. The things that are kind of a bit more normal, I really enjoyed doing that as well. So a bit of competition and a bit more lighthearted.
Okay, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Matt Dickinson and Alison Rudd.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information, and we'll be back on Thursday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.